Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. Bonterra Organic Estates is one of the best-known wine names in California. Founded by the Fetzer family in 1987, it was organic a long time before organic was trendy. Today, it's also a big business. LeadIQ puts its annual turnover at somewhere between $50 million and $100 million, which is vague, but enough to suggest it's a pretty big number. So it's certainly got the resources to be innovative, but I was curious to know what innovation looks like for a company that's so tied to traditional values like organic, biodynamic, and regenerative farming. The person to speak to is Kate Herbert, the Senior Director of Marketing, who has recently ushered a new line called Ranch Wine to market. Now, when I looked at this, I made a huge mistake. I assumed that they'd launched a fruit-infused wine like so many other new products on the market. I've left my mistake in the recording so you can hear the clarification. It turns out that Bonterra has created a truly innovative line using just grapes and winemaking, plus plenty of consumer insights and data. So the story is actually much more interesting than I thought. Now, don't forget, you'll find more insights in the Drinks Insider newsletter, which you'll find at drinksinsider.com. And if you know of any entrepreneurs or products that should be featured on the podcast, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. Kate, first of all, thanks for being here. But second, I hope you don't mind, I had a look at your CV and you have worked in enormous FMCG companies like General Mills and J.M. Smucker. Did I pronounce that right? Smucker.
Smucker, yes.
And now you work in wine, which is a tiny area that's nothing like FMCG. So how long have you been in wine? What convinced you to move into it and how do you find it?
Well, I'm crazy is what convinced me to move into
Clearly.
Thank you so much for having me. This is really
You're
exciting.
Welcome.
You know, it's less than a year. I think maybe 9 months. I've been in this industry, but yes, I know my background really is pretty primarily CPG driven. So consumer packaged goods, both on the ad agency side was the sort of infancy of my career, the first about decade. And then I shifted over to the client side about halfway through. So another 10 years on the client side, but it definitely worked for big CPG companies and made the shift to wine. Honestly, I'm located in Northern California. I've always had an affinity for wine and was really excited to sort of put some roots down, pun intended and not, in the category here and kind of build out my community in Northern California, given, you know, a ton of folks I interface with are in the industry. So when the opportunity emerged, I took it.
Now, we're about to talk about something that's extremely innovative in the category. Is that why you were brought on board? Because you've got that kind of view of what works in FMCG and in sort of launching new products?
You know, I think CPG is a space that a lot of the wine sector has looked to. They're pretty historically deeply resourced, though, which is it's quite different. I think they're
yes.
very data-driven, very
That's correct, yes.
One of the most massive changes that I've experienced. But really, a classical CPG background is consumer first, number one. Always consumer first, data-driven, insight-driven, and also driven by innovation. So I think there's a lot to actually be gleaned from the CPG space over into wine. So is that why? You know, probably had a little bit to do with it, I'm certain.
Okay, so what surprised you the most? I mean, I guess most people I've spoken to who come from your kind of background are very surprised to find that the wine trade looks very glamorous from the front, but at the back end doesn't quite have the glamour and money that certainly General Mills has got. Were you surprised when you found out the reality inside the wine industry?
In terms of resourcing, certainly.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
you know,
an approach.
Yeah, I think it is a very different challenge. And one, not only are the resourcing quite different, but the competitive set is unbelievably massive. So, yeah, I mean, I think the latest I heard is 110,000 SKUs that people have
wow.
to choose from. So, you know, just the competitive set in that landscape is just unwieldy.
Yeah, we also say it's the only segment where people spend their profits on the competitor. That's the other thing about wine. So one of the other things I noticed is You at some stage worked in the pet sector, which is my favourite topic outside of wine. Can you talk about that? What were you doing? What segment? How did you get into it?
Yeah, pet was fascinating. And there are actually quite a few parallels just from a marketing standpoint that you'd be surprised are relevant.
Go on, surprise me.
Yeah, I mean, when I was there, you know, it was actually a CPG organization. We divested our people business and became just a pet exclusive private equity owned pet business. So we, again, were pretty classically deeply resourced, but we were doing things like neuroscience, I mean, 15 years ago. And some of what I learned, I carry with me today from a principal standpoint. You know, pet food is a consumable at the end of the day. So, you know, certainly
okay,
you're not.
Hang on a second. I have to find that. You've got insights from neuroscience and you've got insights from the pet sector that you still use today. What's your top pet sector insight that you take to other industries?
You'd be surprised, but the health halo is actually very predominant in pet. If you look at a pet ad, so say a dog food commercial, and the person in the background, the pet parent, is preparing for themselves something healthy. So salad, or they have vegetables on a platter or something. There's an implicit association for the viewer that if they treat themselves that way and they feed themselves healthy, then they must also feed their dog healthy. So there's sort of this correlation between the human health that then halos onto that pet brand.
That is so interesting. You know, for a long time, before Twitter became a cesspool, I used to follow all the scientists from the Mars pet laboratory. Mm-hmm. There were like dozens and dozens of them. And they were all talking about what they call the tuna fish problem, which is cats love tuna fish, but they couldn't see an evolutionary reason why, because tuna is a deep sea fish that cats couldn't have fished in the evolutionary past.
Yes.
But they put huge resources. Anyway, that's a different topic. But okay, that's fascinating. All right. So one of the things that makes alcohol very different from these other sectors is it has far more legalities and sensitivities. Like you mentioned the health halo, which is something that's absolutely forbidden in wine. So already it's got difficulties to market compared to other categories. Was that a surprise?
Yes and no. I mean, I think there's similarities when you're marketing to children, honestly, coming from General Mills and working on Annie's and a lot of the sort of more kid-focused brands. So I certainly had that filter in my mind. Bonterra is also so deeply resourced with such incredible talent that has really deep experience that I've relied on to help me as I navigate some of those challenges.
Fair enough. All right. So we're here to talk about a very innovative product called ranch wine. First of all, we have a lot of listeners from outside the United States who don't understand what ranch water is. Can you explain what that is? And then we'll talk about ranch wine.
Yeah, ranch water is actually a pretty pervasive cocktail out here in the United States, which is predominantly tequila, soda water, and lime. It's really that simple. But they've actually translated that into its own segment within the RTD space. And I think last I checked, it was $115 million business is this ranch water segment.
Okay. So how did you go from looking at that opportunity to actually creating a wine? Can you talk about how the concept came about?
Certainly. I mean, I think we really challenged ourselves to say, you know, when I first came into the industry and I said, oh my gosh, you know, this industry's lost $2 billion in the last 5 years. This is a share game. You know, this is a matter of, this is a zero sum game. How can we eke out some share? But as soon as we really started to think about ourselves less as a wine brand and more of a beverage brand, that opened opportunity like you wouldn't believe. So that really helped us to interrogate our portfolio, looking through the lens of the Bonterra business and the Bonterra brand as a beverage brand. And then we could take a look at kind of market trends that went beyond wine. What is driving choice? What are driving these younger consumers to make choices across their beverage occasions? And interrogate our business to say, well, our portfolio is pretty well positioned when it comes to wine. You know, we've got a beautiful Sauvignon Blanc and Pinot Gris. Both are the only two varietals in the top 20 growing right now. So that's fantastic. Mm. But what do we not have? Where are we not participating that we could be participating with an offering if we really pushed ourselves? And that's when we came up with the insight around this refreshing connections demand space. So really thinking consumer first, you know, what is driving their choices? And then where do we not have an offering that there is a ton of demand to be had, but we aren't currently positioned to participate in. So that's what kind of emerged. There was this white space that we just were not servicing.
So where did the ranch wine come into it? Were you sitting in a boardroom going, should we try a wine gin and tonic? Should we try a wine margarita? Should we try, I mean, was it that process of iteration or was something else that we went, actually, nobody's trying this, we should try this? What was the, how did you conceptually come up with it?
Yeah, I mean, we were intrigued by ranch water. I mean, when I saw that there was a $115 million tag, you know, price tag connected to that segment alone, and we said, well, man, we could do that. You know, we could deliver a really refreshing, flavor-forward, delicious option through wine. Has anyone done ranch wine? You know, that's certainly something we could accomplish. And so we did a little kind of desk side research and had determined that, no, that actually had not been something that had been explored before. So the concept came to life really through the lens of being intrigued and inspired by this RTD kind of more seltzer forward space, and then trying to apply that to how we might be able to deliver something like that in the wine space.
Okay. Now, sometimes there's white space because there's an opportunity, and sometimes there's white space because somebody has tried it and it hasn't worked. How do you tell the difference between those? Is it just that the RTD category in wine is so wide open right now that you can try lots of things, or is it that just nobody had come up with this before?
Oh, man, I think it's a combination of both. I think we can't just make a hypothesis and then just try to launch it. We certainly needed to connect with consumers and have an understanding. You know, we put this hypothesis out there. We developed a concept. We worked hand in hand with our winemaking team to deliver a proposition that we felt could actually live up to the concept. Because ultimately, you have to deliver. You can't develop an idea and then, you know, you put a product out there and it doesn't pay it off. So we had the research to show us, we know where younger consumers are going. We know what they're interested in. We see the segments and the sectors that are growing. We are not participating there. We have this concept that we think could speak to them. That's really when we started to bring in some more insights and leveraging some platforms to help us really get a sense of whether or not this concept was moving the needle with consumers.
All right. So what I want to do is I want to completely break this down from how you came up with the concept to finally how you get something for market. Okay. So I presume you've got a concept first. You've been looking at research, you know, that it needs to be refreshing and so on. And you've got the concept. What happens next? Do you contact flavor companies? Do you come up with prototypes? Do you test it on consumers? Tell me what happens once you've got the concept.
Well, first we had to talk to winemaking. I mean, we had to talk to them and say, hey, is this something you feel confident you could deliver with just grapes? We are not going to do additives. We are not going to bring in artificials or artificial flavors. We needed to deliver something that could be done strictly leveraging what we had access to, which is a phenomenal supply of grapes. So we worked through that. We developed the idea. Immediately, the first thing we did actually was put together package concepts, because we know that's our billboard. That's what consumers are going to see first and foremost. So we put together some packaging concepts and we threw it into a survey, a consumer survey. Said, hey, help us understand. Are you intrigued by this? What do you expect this to taste like? Are these flavors of interest to you? Would you buy this? Do you drink wine? And if you do drink wine, would you drink this? So what we were able to unearth is, one, I think it was like 85% of people who don't drink wine found the proposition compelling and said they would buy it. But what helped hedge our bet was that the folks who do drink wine also said that they found it compelling. So that was really exciting and intriguing for us as we think about driving incrementality both within our portfolio, but also helping to try to drive demand beyond wine and start to fish from some of those other categories that we aren't currently participating in.
Okay. So when you were talking about the research you've done, you went to big houses like Numerator and so on. So was that the research that you did before you began working on the concept, or did you work on the concept and then look further at research?
Both. I mean, Numerator helped us kind of figure out where to fish. So Numerator helped us with what are the category drivers? What are the nuanced differences between the different demographics? I think staggeringly, which maybe is not surprising for those in the wine industry, but for every 60-year-old who stops drinking wine, we bring in a new legal drinking age person who is 50% less likely to choose wine. So we really had to understand, what is motivating this younger generation? What are they drinking? What are they seeking? And how are they making those decisions and choices? And only then could we come up with a concept to try to meet those needs. And so then Cidex helped us really define and craft the concept specifically for them.
Okay, so I've realized I've made a colossal mistake in looking at your material. So you've got names like pineapple key lime, strawberry hibiscus, and you're saying this is made solely with grapes. How do you do that?
Yeah. I mean, what we did is we knew, and one of the biggest differences between Gen Z and all the other demographics when we did our consumer research initially was that they are not driven by varietal. They just, yeah. it's not one of their top drivers of choice. So that alone helped really helped free us from being a varietally driven proposition. And so what we wanted to do was borrow inspiration from some of these categories they are shopping and they are drinking, like these RTDs and seltzers. Black cherry is the number one flavor from White Claw, for example. Mango, pineapple, lime. These are all flavors that they're really familiar with and that they're already shopping. So what we wanted to do is how do we pull those flavors out?
Oh, I see. All right. No, I really have misunderstood because, of course, there are lots of wine spritzers that are infused with aromatized, fruit flavors. So this is not what you're talking about. You're talking about this is absolutely a wine product.
Absolutely. Okay. Just wine. We pulled the flavor note out and put it front and center.
I'm probably not the only person who's going to be confused by that. How do you make sure that people understand that this is wine? This isn't something that's got other things in it.
Yeah, I mean, we're continuing to iterate and actually getting this feedback as we sample the product and as we demo the product. We've already moved on to our second back label iteration to just reinforce crystal clear, flavorful, not flavored, just wine, not too sweet, not too serious.
Okay. All right. Well, okay. So this makes it even more interesting because you're playing in the space, but you're not doing any of the things that I was expecting that you were going to tell me about aromatized fruit flavors and so on. Okay. So this is really interesting. So did you face skepticism from wine drinkers that this was just wine? How did you overcome that?
You know, even some of our own winemakers in the organization would taste it and say, oh my God, really? There's nothing in here? And I attribute that certainly to Margaret, our fantastic winemaker, but she's done just an incredible job of pulling flavor forward and ensuring that tasting note can be front and center. And of course these tasting notes are strawberry and they're pineapple and they're cherry and they're things that people are familiar with. But I'll tell you, when you taste it, you absolutely get that right away.
Goodness gracious. And it's only 11% ABV. Do you remove any alcohol or is this natural all the way?
No, it's natural. In fact, we were hoping that we might be able to go a little lower, but you lost the flavor. So yeah, they're about 11%, which is a more modest ABV, which we knew would also really resonate with this Gen Z consumer.
I think it would resonate with European consumers. Actually, I think you need to export this. I honestly, when I read the tech sheets and everything, I didn't read them that closely, obviously, but because of the way it's described, because there are so many wines now that are using the RTDs and the seltzers and they're using fruit infusions. So, right. So this is an amazing story. All right. So let's go back to the research a bit and about Gen Z and being refreshing. What else did you learn about this cohort, which everybody is obsessed with at the moment?
Yeah, I think that they were absolutely fascinating. I have grown such empathy and appreciation for them. I think the most interesting thing outside of, the flavor varietal, or excuse me, the varietals not really motivating them is, when you ask a Gen Z consumer, even those who do dabble in wine or drink wine, what would you replace your wine with? I mean, any number of items was on the table for them. When you compare that to a boomer, a Gen X, a millennial, any other demographic set, and you say, what would you replace your wine with? Maybe beer, maybe a cocktail. But for Gen Z, I mean, it's a hard seltzer. It's a sparkling water. It's a tea. It's a, anything's on the table. So they just, they don't connect their occasion as a beverage first occasion. When I was growing up in San Francisco running around, you'd have a friend who'd say, I'm not going out tonight. I'm not drinking. Like those two things were so inextricably linked that socializing and drinking went hand in hand. They went together. But for this consumer, they're social first, their connections first. And then the beverage is maybe second or third. It's not playing a starring role in their life.
Okay, so even given that, we also know that Gen Z aren't really choosing wine. Did you find out what some of those barriers were? Is it about the 750ml bottle? Is there something about wine and its flavors? Is there something about the aura around wine? What sort of are the barriers to adopting wine in this group?
I mean, I think it's one thing that we had thought it could be was the packaging. And in part of our research, we actually showed them a version of this in a can. And their preference was the 750, which was really exciting.
That's interesting.
I think one of the exciting things too for us is that, it's a screw cap and it's for four people, for three, four, five people, you can share this. This really is about sharing versus when you have that individual can, that's something that you're having yourself, and it's less of a shareable moment. So we thought that was something we could lean into. But what we did find is that the reason that they're not choosing wine was just as interesting as the reason that they are. The reason that they are not is that it's just too formal. It's just too formal. It's just too serious. It's not casual enough for the occasions that they're interested in. But when they do choose it, it's for a nice dinner or a date night, which how many nice dinners are you going out to when you're 22, 23, 24, 25? Well,
how many nice dinners am I going out to now?
Exactly.
Okay. So this is opening up lots and lots of questions. One of the things years ago, I did a story where I was asking about how, you know, what the pathway into wine is. And I spoke to some analysts from some really big companies, and all of them said that it's not really about the taste at an early stage. It's about becoming, creating an identity as a wine drinker. So it's really important. It doesn't matter what you drink, but what's really important is that you start to think of yourself as a wine drinker. Do you think the days when you could get someone to think of themselves as a wine drinker as part of their identity are gone, and wine is always going to be just something on the shelf with all of these other things as well?
I mean, absolutely not. I think we can certainly create a new identity for wine. And that's one thing that we've been working really hard to try to show people is this proposition is intended to be drunk in a rocks glass over ice. It's actually fantastic with a tahine rim, with a salt rim. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are really breaking the conventional expectations of wine and trying to show these folks you actually are a wine drinker. You just maybe don't know it.
Okay. So now you've got some samples, I presume. You've got some flavors. You've mm-hmm. got some very clever winemaking. How did you go and test it in the market? What sort of sampling programs did you do?
Well, demo is absolutely critical here. I mean, in particular, it's not only just so that they can taste it and experience how delicious and refreshing it is, but to show the use case. Because even interestingly, as we've partnered with, you know, influencers, you know, one thing that we know, these consumers are not walking the wine aisle. So we have to find them. We need to create discovery for them. They're not going to go into your typical retailer and walk up and down the wine aisle and explore. So we needed to go to them. We needed to find them. We needed to create that demand kind of in advance, which of course means in the social space. So, you know, partnering with platforms like TikTok, for example, and showing up there and bringing influencers to the table. But the really surprising thing was even our influencers that were briefing and telling them how to drink this, they still had a tough time not putting it in a stemmed glass. You know, we're telling them, like, put it over
That's
ice,
really
put it in a rocks glass. We're sending them rocks glasses. We're sending them salt and tahine. And they still have a tough time. So it's just, it's such a hard convention to break that we've had to work really, really hard. We've changed the screw cap to say nice over ice. We've put a picture on the back of the label now in the second round with it in a rocks glass with ice and a rim, you know, so we're working to try to kind of help educate and give them permission. I think permission to play is a space that wine hasn't maybe ventured into. And by creating the sub brand, it's really enabling us to do that really hard and really fast.
Okay, this is raising questions in my mind about the influencer culture, which is, I have to admit, something I don't know as much as I should. But it's interesting that you needed to teach them how to do it. So, first of all, that suggests to me that the level of creativity is less than I would have hoped, that actually maybe if people are just used to producing the brand, here's the brand. I don't know, how do you brief people to think differently?
Visual goes a very long way. So we, in fact, shot a picture of the wine in four different glasses with different, you know, over ice, with a rim, with a garnish. You know, we want to show people. In fact, we created cards that we included in the influencer kits that had these visuals on it and said, permission to play, please experiment. You know, so we've had to reinforce it every which way. And you can imagine with our sales teams too, you know, they're going out and sampling this with buyers and with retailers and potential customers. And, you know, it's critical that they deliver the experience for them in the way that we want, you know, that's best received. So this product is over ice with a rim is fantastic. It's a really different experience in a stemmed glass. You know, it's not as optimal.
That is so interesting. So I imagine that if you're struggling to get influencers to do this, you must have been struggling with your sales team as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. You know, we've actually created. Never did I think that I would create a salt and tahine rim kit, but it has been so well received. You would be shocked at the response that we get with demos.
That's interesting. What was the moment where you thought to yourself, oh my God, we have to go and create a salt rim kit?
I mean, we just said, do these things even exist? Can we create these branded? But it's been so positively received that by arming and enabling our sales team to do a better job in explaining and describing the experience and showing the experience, it's been fantastic.
You know, the way life works, it'll probably turn out that your salt rim kit is the thing that makes you millions upon millions of dollars.
oh my God. But you know, I'll tell you though, what we've seen, which is just so exciting, is of the new pods that we've gotten for Ranch Wine, so the new points of distribution, 40% of them are net new to our brand.
Wow.
Which is incredible. You know, so it's showing that we're able to kind of take this proposition into new spaces that we haven't really played before. So it's opening up new ponds to fish.
So one of the issues, I've spoken to a lot of people in the non-alcoholic space. One of the things that becomes a problem when you're breaking a mold is that it can be hard to find a place on the shelf, or it can be hard to convince retailers that you're doing something different. Was that also a problem that you had to overcome?
I would say it's more parameters. So how do we set those guidelines? Because you're exactly right. This thing, you know, putting this in with the varietal set, it's not going to speak to the consumers we're trying to source from. So first of all, display. I mean, we know if we can get this out of aisle on display, ultimately that's going to be the absolute best location for it. But secondarily, you know, we need to be with the RTDs and the cocktails and the seltzers to the extent that we can be.
That's so interesting. All right. Now, I came up with some questions to ask you, which are all based on the falsehood that this was a aromatized product, which is obviously not. but you're going to be very limited by your winemaking. How many brand extensions do you think you can do? Have you done as much as can be done in this space and then you need to think of new products? Or is this something that you can extend in other ways?
Meaning in terms of flavor?
Yeah.
Yeah,
can you do one that's more pineapple? Can you do one that's more, I don't know, peachy?
It's interesting that you say that, Felicity. Well, we're in harvest right now. And so actually our winemaking team is texting live, you know, some examples of some new options and ideas that they have moving forward. I would say that honestly, the road is endless. Because it's not varietally specific, we're able to really experiment and really play and pull forward some of those tasting notes. Look, we've asked them, can you do X, Y, or Z? And they'll say, that might be tough to do with just wine. But there are other places that they feel super confident that they could pull flavor notes forward. So I would say the pipeline's pretty deep.
Well, I suppose what this opens up is, you know, we know that red wines are struggling more than they were, but I mean, this is the perfect space for the chillable red, with the salt and everything else. So how far can you push this, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, the cherry is the only one that we call chillable. So the other two are pineapple, key lime, and then strawberry hibiscus. But for the red in particular, people don't think to put red wine in the fridge. You know, maybe some do, but certainly not everybody, and certainly not the younger consumer that we're looking to connect with. So we called it chillable cherry on purpose so that they would know this is intended to be chilled.
Yeah, so now you're really trying to break the mold. So it's like, you know, salt rim, different glass, and you have to put it in the fridge. You know, that's actually a lot of change. Have you had any organic social media from are people beginning to show it on social media on their own bat?
You know, one of the things that we've started to see is, I'm sure you've seen the trend of adding Coke to your red wine.
I haven't. Oh my God. Tell me about that.
Oh my goodness. Well, in Latin American countries and in South America, they have what's called a calimocho or a tinto, which is just red wine and Coke.
Oh, Verona de Tinto is becoming a
yes, exactly,
big popular.
Exactly. That's right, yeah. Yeah, so we've started to kind of try to plant some seeds there around our chillable cherry with Coke. And interestingly, you know, Texas is a very important market. And Dr. Pepper is, you know, Texas is the home of Dr. Pepper. So we've been doing some experimenting with a Texas Tinto, which is our Dr. Pepper and chillable cherry combination, which is absolutely fantastic.
It's actually surprising it's taken so long, because, you know, when wine first went into China, the first thing they did was add Coke to it, and they got a lot of sneering from Western people. But now that red wine is spreading in Africa, they're doing exactly the same thing. So there's obviously a natural pairing with Coke that the wine trade has completely missed.
Well, and it's something novel. You know, it's like people like the jalapenos in your Sauvignon Blanc. It's those things that are unexpected that people are willing to try. So it's early days, you know, we just launched, but we're starting to see some of that momentum as we're out sampling with folks. They're really keen to try and to experiment.
And have you thought about that? Are the people at Bonterra going, well, if the jalapeno works, should we try this in there? You know, should we try this? Are you adding things in? I don't mean as a flavor, I mean as in actually in the glass.
Yeah, I mean, well, jalapenos for sure. You know, fruit, sangria is a really natural connection for red. So I think it's giving people freedom to operate with zero judgment. We joke that our like tagline is no rules, just vibes. And we really truly are trying to live by that internally as well. I mean, this has been a lot of fun for our internal team to break that convention and free them up and have some fun.
All right, let's talk about resources. From woe to go, from sitting around going, I've got this idea, to actually getting on the shelf. What time span are we talking about?
I can't be quoted because I don't know with 100% certainty, but I think this may actually be the fastest from concept to market in our company's history. It was something that was concepted within 5 months, like from concept to shelf. But what that means, honestly, I never could have done this at General Mills. We never could have done this in a big CPG space because we didn't have the agility. There were so many layers and there's so many, you know, so much red tape That's you have to go through. That here That's it was like, you make a call, you're given something to try, or you've got all the team in the room to make real life decisions. And we have the freedom to operate from our leadership team. So that was actually the biggest surprise in the wine space, was just how nimble we could be.
That is so interesting. Do you think it's just because somebody like General Mills is huge, and also they have to answer to shareholders? You know, there's a whole bunch of people that, you know, are going to complain if they don't do really well. Or is it something about wine, do you think, is more flexible, or all of the above?
I certainly think all of the above, but I think what went really far for us was having that data. So proving out the consumer insight was there, the purchase interest that was there, the data supported it. You know, what got us here won't get us there. And I think there's a huge appetite in wine right now to do what we can to help grow this pie. And, you know, when I first came in, like I said, I thought, all right, zero sum game. It's about share. It's about competitiveness. Absolutely not. This is about bringing new people in. This is about looking at ourselves as a beverage business, not a wine business. You know, so unlocking some of the shackles, I think, that we've been held accountable to in years past, I think there's just an appetite for it.
Okay, so next question is, what sort of volumes are we talking about? I mean, is this something that's gone national, or at the moment, is it just in some markets while you're testing it? And, you know, how big is it?
We've had really strong interest. So I'd say initially we had talked about doing, you know, maybe 15,000 cases just to start to kind of hedge our bets. 5,000 cases of each flavor. We ended up having to double, in fact, triple that. So I think we're going to be looking at about 50,000 case business in the first 6 months.
Okay, so that's huge. And again, about geography, is it everywhere in the United States, or is it just in some markets at the moment?
Everywhere. Yep, national. Everywhere. National launch.
Okay, so that's got what they call velocity. Okay, so let's talk generally around Bonterra now. Now, Bonterra is a kind of a hallowed name because of its organic and regenerative heritage. Mm-hmm. So, what are the challenges about introducing such a novel? I mean, it is a wine product; we've established that. But from, you know, a winery that's very much associated with an idealistic view of agriculture and heritage, were there issues around that?
Oh my gosh. I think that's what's given us permission. You know, the Bonterra brand has been around and is known for sustainable practices and advancing sustainability across it, you know, any number of places and spaces. So it was really important for us to continue to evolve this as a Bonterra brand. This was not intended to be, you know, a brand new brand that was kind of outside of our portfolio. We very much wanted this to expand and extend our portfolio so that we would have offerings across the broad spectrum from, you know, our single vineyard offerings up at the upper echelon through to something that could really bridge consumers into our proposition. So, you know, sustainability is embedded in everything we do.
All right, so let's move the conversation on. I will come back round to this, the idea of thinking of yourself as a beverage company, because that's very interesting. But let's talk about organic wines and organic September. You did a survey of US wine consumers, and what did you discover?
Yeah, I mean, you know, interestingly, not surprising, but as we think about our core business, you know, the wine industry is experiencing a loss of kind of occasion. So we need to compel more consumption. And so as we looked at our consumers and said, well, when are they drinking wine? And it's really not super different from the younger generation in terms of date night. It's, you know, it's nice dinners. For us, you know, the younger consumer just having fewer and fewer of those. So how do we crack into occasions that are not just date night? But one of the things that we were kind of laughing about is, well, how do we create more date nights? You know, and actually as we went into that research, one of my hypotheses was, I would bet you that people are drinking more when they're with their parents. You know, it's that sort of age old, the boomers are the wine drinkers. And I figured we're going to be coming up with a campaign to try to get, you know, parents to hang out with their kids more, and that can help increase wine consumption.
That's so interesting, because there's actually quite a lot of research that shows that, first of all, Gen Z has a much better set of relationships with their parents than certainly my generation, Gen X, did, that they're much closer in general to their parents. But secondly, more of them are living at home for longer in multi-generation households. Do you see that as an opportunity?
I mean, certainly. I think the way that we look at this is we want to create connections, you know, and whether those are social spaces out in, you know, bars at trivia nights, or whether it's sort of helping create, you know, more relationships out there. We're exploring kind of early days, but we're trying to find some fun ways to encourage more of these moments to happen so that we can
So you've taken Bonterra into salt rim kits, glassware, and now into dating services.
Yeah, exactly.
This is serious brand extension time. And what about other occasions? You know, there's a lot of research now about you know, people spending more time in their room alone, gaming, or also things like book clubs and chess clubs, and, you know, all of those sorts of things, that there's really sort of fragmentation happening in the social space. First of all, do you think that's true? And secondly, if it is true, how do you get wine into those spaces?
I mean, that's fine. I definitely think it's true. And I think, you know, that's the thing. We have to find a connection that makes sense. We were joking yesterday about one of the trends is these run clubs, you know, running clubs. And we said, well, could we see ourselves there? And it's like, well, maybe not. So what we're trying to do is just, we want to show up where the people are going. You know, we want to participate in some of these moments and these occasions that people are naturally showing up in. So I mentioned trivia nights, you know, that's a huge trend. It's getting people out there IRL, having experiences in real life. These younger generations, they are craving connections. You know, they're craving more relationships in real life. And I think they're starting to sort of shift away from some of those online dating platforms and shifting away from some of the, you know, the social platforms in service of more real life experiences. So to the extent that we can help be part of those, you know, we're going to put them out.
How do you actually get wine into those places? Do you just rely on people picking it up on the retail store on their way, or is there a way that you can put it in front of them?
Well, the easiest thing is to try to get involved in something that's already existing. So if there's an occasion, if there's a moment that's already happening, can we show up and sponsor it? Can we show up and sample there? You know, but to your point earlier about, you know, there are limitations with alcohol. You can't just sample alcohol like you do with a snack bar. So it is, you know, it is challenging to find some of those parameters that we can kind of find ourselves, our friends, ourselves in more naturally.
That's so interesting. So what did you put it on TikTok? So saying, if you'd like us to come along to your trivia night and pour you some, you know,
I mean, we've joked about that. You know, we've joked about it. How do you create more occasions for people to connect? And I think some of the research that we've read too about, you know, the younger consumer is that they don't actually know how to flirt. They don't know how to meet people in real life. And so can we create kits that can help them? Here are 10 topics of conversation, you know, and a bottle of wine, like ready, set, go.
You should do that. So I spent a lot of time earlier this year looking at some of the public health literature around Gen Z and alcohol. And one of the things that came out really strongly is exactly this, that social media has completely eroded social skills. But in another way, it's also meant that you don't have to go out and meet people on dates, because you can just do it all with emojis, and it lowers the temperature. Instead of, you know, facing rejection, you can just send an emoji, and if they don't send it back, well, you know, there's no harm done.
Exactly.
Yeah, but maybe you do need to, you know, trivia nights plus here's your speed dating card. I think I can see a whole bunch of brand extensions that you know will take you well out of wine.
Absolutely.
So let's go back to the organic question. You know, there's a lot of you know, surveys that show that younger people are very interested in sustainability and so on. How much do you think that matters when it actually comes to them spending money? Is that just a justification for doing something they would have done anyway? Or is it a driver of how people spend money?
First of all, the younger generation, sustainability and organic is something that they've grown up with. You know, it isn't like back, you know, in the 80s and 90s, the organic industry really had to educate people on what organic means and why it matters and how different it is. For this consumer, it's a lot more pervasive in their life, and it isn't something you necessarily need to convince them of. And they are more sustainably driven. But what we do know, and hey, look, we're the number one organic player in the country. So, you know, organic matters to us quite a bit, and the role it plays in people's decision-making matters quite a bit. But again, you know, some of the research we found, we recognize it is not going to drive the purchase. I don't go to the store saying, you know what, I'm going to go buy something organic today. But when I'm there and I'm looking at a set of conventional strawberries versus organic strawberries, the choice I'm going to make is very much the tie broken by organic. And we're seeing that come to life in wine as well. And organic is actually what we've found is that one, people want more access to organic wine. And two, when all things are equal, you know, taste, kind of quality, price, organic is a very meaningful tiebreaker. So ensuring that what we need to deliver on is taste is king. Any consumable, whether pet food, whether kid mac and cheese, whether wine. If you're not delicious, people are not going to buy you. And they're certainly not going to try you.
But you actually can't fool your dog.
Absolutely not. No, I mean, really, that's one of those things in across any consumable, I would argue, that you're in. And so delicious done better is how we think about Bonterra. We deliver a delicious wine.
Mm-hmm. Is there a difference in the way you sample for pet foods and the way you sample for other types of food? Like, do you bring the dogs in and they get all different choices? Like, how does the sampling work when you're talking about dogs and cats?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. No, very different. The thing too about pet food is that when people get to the store, the majority of the time, they already know what they're going to buy. So you know, because you don't want to change your dog food very often. So, you know, you have to get to them before they're even in that store. So sometimes it's a matter of a little sample pack in something they might already be buying, which is why it's really nice.
No. I meant, how do you make sure the dogs and cats like it? Like, do they get taste tests as well?
You absolutely know. If they're ferociously going after it, then you know that they like it.
Must be easier supplying cats, you know, because every so often cats just go, no, I'm not touching that.
Oh my gosh.
For no reason.
They are finicky. I'll tell you, they're finicky.
Do you have pets yourself? Like, if you work for a pet food sector, are you obliged to have pets?
I think it's encouraged. And I do actually, she's right behind. Oh no, she's usually right behind me. I have a golden retriever.
Oh, lovely. Okay, so we're here to talk about wine. So you've got all these insights from Gen Z. You've got this fantastic new product and so on. Did you get any insights from that you can use for other consumer segments, do you think?
I think the same approach that we've taken to interrogating our portfolio and unlocking pockets we are not currently participating in is a blueprint that we will be taking forward. So ranch wine, we're over the moon about, absolutely committed to, but there are certainly other pockets within beverage that we have not tapped into yet that we have ambition to tap into.
Would you consider doing something like a spritzer where it's a can of wine and something else?
I don't think anything's off the table. You know, I really don't. I think we're open to growing. And I think the one filter that we will use is going to be incrementality. We don't want to cannibalize our portfolio where we have something already that can do the job. We want to really challenge ourselves to drive incremental growth with new consumers in new occasions.
When you've got something that's very new like this, so first of all, I take it you can sample it at cellar door. Did you do that?
I'm sorry?
Did you sample it through the cellar door? Like, how much did you put it out there for people to try?
We have sampled it in front of numerous audiences. So buyers, retailers, trade shows, consumer events, internally. Across the board. We've sent it to influencers, to trade. We're open for feedback. I think that's the other thing, is that we're iterating. You know, we're agile. We're getting feedback. And as we see something that maybe isn't working as hard as it could, we will adjust.
So I guess the thing is, even if you're a powerful company like Bonterra, you still have to convince the distributor to take it on.
Yeah.
You still have to convince the retailer that there's a place for it. And it is difficult when you're trying to change the category in some way. So what sort of problems did you have and how did you overcome them?
Well, we absolutely had to do activations with our distributors. So that's something we hadn't done in quite a while. So we did in-person key markets. We brought all our partners to the table and we sampled it. And we actually did sample stations where they could try it in different ways at each of the stations. So one over ice, another one in a cocktail, another one with a rim, with a garnish. You know, we just reinforced the versatility across different use cases so that they themselves could experience it and really understand how it's different and how it's intended to be served so that they could then go and have that conversation with the next stakeholder.
Oh, that's interesting. All right. So what's next for Bonterra?
Well, Ranch Wine isn't holding back. I'd say we're eager to continue to expand the ranch, so to speak. So there'll be more coming in 2026. And I think we also have some fantastic wines within our core offering. I think the one shift you're going to see probably in the market is just getting really tight on our deliciousness. That, you know, we are a delicious wine. Our Sauvignon Blanc is an absolute hero item that we look forward to continuing to expand distribution around. We have a beautiful Pinot Gris. So kind of following the trends as the market tells us, you know, we see the same data everyone else does. So we know refreshing whites are on the uptick. For us, it's a matter of compelling more consumption, connecting with our consumer. You know, we're an affordable, delicious, high quality wine, and we want to act like, you know, an attainable kind of, we don't want to come across as snotty or snobby or pretentious in any way. We want to welcome people in. So we want to welcome them to the table.
All right. On that positive note, I'll say thank you so much for talking to me.
Oh, thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome. Thank you.